Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us. This week is National Pollinator Awareness Week. And today on the show, we're going to talk about keeping bees and also how to protect and provide for bees in the community. Do you want to start keeping bees, or would you rather just eat local honey and support local bee colonies from afar? We'd like to hear from you. We'll hear from local beekeepers and educators about how to keep honey flowing and flowers pollinated. You can email callinshow@kunm.org. You can post your comments online, or you can call in live during the show. We're talking this morning with Jody Hedrick. She is with the City of Albuquerque Open Space Division. Kate Whalen is with the Sangre de Cristo Beekeepers, and she joins us by phone from Santa Fe. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Ellie.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I wanted to start out with each of you and ask you each to explain how you got into beekeeping in the first place. Jody, can you start us off with that? Explain how your relationship with bees began.
Well, working for the Open Space Division, part of the Open Space Division is about 360 acres of farmland. Several years ago, a local beekeeper approached us and asked if he could keep hives on one of our farms. And it started there. So he invited myself and another staff person to be involved with the beekeeping. And soon after that, Les Crowder, a very well-known New Mexico beekeeper, requested to have a summer-long workshop series at the Visitor Center. And after Les's workshop, I was hooked. And now we have 9 hives at the Visitor Center and 2 at Candelaria Farm.
So what was it that hooked you?
Oh, my. It's an amazing organism at the hive itself. The honeybees have different jobs. They all contribute to the health and survival of the hive. They all cooperate. It's an amazing creature. It's an amazing creature.
Kate, what about you? How did you get hooked on bees?
Well, it was actually quite similar. Years ago, Les Crowder was my teacher. And he was teaching here in Santa Fe at the Ecoversity Bee Yard, and that was my introduction to the world of bees. And he was such a wonderful teacher. This was a certification program at that time that's similar to what the Open Space Center now is offering, which offers mentoring and instruction throughout the season, and it was just a really wonderful experience. And I think once you stick your foot in that door, it is just as Jody described, the most amazing structure, societal structure, and an amazing organism. And I think honeybees are the most studied organism next to man. So there's a wealth of information and research. And it's almost like science fiction. Really quite interesting.
Well, so, Jody, can you start us off with a little bit of an explanation? I mean, many of us know honey. Mm-hmm. We may eat honey or cook with it or just be familiar with it. But what else do bees do besides make honey?
Well, I think it's important to just think about the role of pollination. 80% of the flowering plants in the world depend on a pollinator to transport that pollen so that plants can propagate. A third of those plants are foods that we depend on. So imagine a world without strawberries and peaches and chili and all of those wonderful things we enjoy every day. If we don't have the majority of those pollinators are insects. There are also lemurs and bats and, you know, hummingbirds and even people. But insects do the majority of that work.
And so some of the other pollinators that are kind of being honored during mm-hmm. Pollinator Awareness Week, go through a couple of those for
okay,
me.
Okay, so it's bees and wasps, flies, bees, wasps, flies, moss, butterflies are the the core pollinators.
And then you were talking about lemurs?
Yes.
Do lemurs actually do pollination?
Well, I don't think
intentionally. Do they do it with their tails?
I don't actually don't know. I don't know how they achieved that.
I digress. Yes. You caught me at lemur.
You can refer to Xerces because they make a reference to it.
So the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation is one of the links that we've posted online at KUNM.org. There are a lot of resources online if you'd like to check it out. And we're talking about bees today. It is Pollinator Awareness Week, and we're talking mainly about bees today. Joined in the studio by Jody Hedrig. Kate Whalen is on the phone, and Melanie Kirby has just joined us, and we'll get to her in just a moment. Kate, did you want to add anything to this kind of foundational discussion of the importance of pollinators?
Well, I think Jody did a great job, and I think the media, I have to give credit really to overall media coverage of the importance of pollinators and the threats that they're facing. So I think it's important to educate yourself a little bit about the needs that you might be able to support in your own backyard, because I think if we approach this on an individual level, we could get some action that we are not getting nationwide. Although there are a lot of different initiatives and a lot of information out there, we definitely need the public to join in this.
So we're definitely going to get to a conversation about what folks can do to support bees, or kind of practices that people can work into their lives that are supporting pollinators. But first, Kate, can you just describe exactly what a bee does when it goes into a flower?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing how the flowers have evolved to attract the bees. So I guess we could start there, that the flowers throughout time have developed both a fragrance that is attractive. Often it's a color. Bees are attracted to certain colors, whereas hummingbirds are attracted to other colors, red, for example. And if you look carefully at many flowers, they actually have what we call guides, flower guides on them, a little almost runway or stripes on the flowers that often have infrared and different light spectrum that only bees can see, that kind of guide them to the flower. But once they're there, and a lot depends on the depth of the throat of the flower as to what pollinator is appropriate for that. So different bees have different lengths of tongues. And so the flowers themselves have developed to have a more or less a specialized pollinator. And once the bee is there, there are bees that specialize in pollen collection and bees that specialize in nectar collection. So kind of depends on the type of flower and what they're producing at that time. But if the bee goes into a flower specifically for pollen, there is an electrostatic charge that develops as the bee flies, and it makes the pollen granules actually, sort of like when you rub a balloon, you know how you can generate that little electric field. So the pollen granules actually adhere to the bee, and the bee has a specialized comb on its legs that it combs that pollen off, and it sticks it into this little basket on its legs that's composed of some specialized hairs. And so then the bee's able to transport that pollen back to the hive. Now, if it's a nectar producing plant that the bee is working with, they have a special extra. They have two stomachs, and they have a specialized stomach called, their honey stomach. And they'll bring that net. They have a really interesting tongue, very muscular, that sucks up the nectar and returns that to the hive, so that other bees will receive it and then process it into honey.
Got it.
So it's really amazing. And then often, once they've been at that flower, they mark it with a pheromone that says, empty, essentially. So the other bees don't waste their time coming to that flower and checking it out. And the flowers also have evolved a system of attracting the bees at a certain time, because it wouldn't make sense from the plant's perspective to spend the entire day secreting nectar. It's kind of a little energy intensive.
Let me bring Melanie Kirby into the conversation. Melanie Kirby is with the Zia Queen Bee Company. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I buzzed right in.
You buzzed right in. I have been refraining from some of the puns that I've had in my mind, like getting stuck on bees or, you know, but Melanie, how did you get into beekeeping? Take us back to that beginning of that relationship.
Wow. It seems like just yesterday, but it was actually close to 18 years ago. I'll be starting my 18th season in the fall. And I actually grew up here in New Mexico. I'm originally from southern New Mexico in Las Cruces area, in the Mesilla Valley, and graduated actually from up in Santa Fe at St. John's College. But I enrolled in the Peace Corps, and that's actually how I was introduced to it, by assignment initially. And I served in Paraguay in South America, and I knew nothing about beekeeping before then.
And that was your project as a Peace Corps volunteer?
That was my assignment, yes. And I, at that point in time, once I got my assignment, I giggled going, what? Wait, is that for real? Well, all right, this will be an adventure. And went to the library, because this was, at the start, this was in 97-ish. So internet was starting, but it wasn't, the main thing. So
you still had to go to the library.
Still had to go to the library, still had to use a card catalog, that whole thing. And just scoured as much as I could in terms of reading. But luckily, they provide you with a training period, which is about 3 months. And so, with cultural immersion and all of that. So I was actually in Paraguay in South America, which is beautiful country, beautiful people. And predominantly worked with Africanized honeybees initially. So I didn't really know commercial beekeeping and American beekeeping until a few years later, when I had the opportunity to then work with commercial beekeepers.
So what was it during your time as a Peace Corps volunteer that got you hooked on bees enough that that you continued working with them after your time in the Peace Corps?
They're marvelous.
Marvelous. To explain.
Well, let's see here. They're extremely resourceful. They're very social. And so they do have a sense of commonwealth to a certain degree. Having studied sort of philosophy as a background, they just really posed a myriad of inquiry for me in terms of behavior and ethics and the natural world, really. So they cooperate together. They're an individual organism, but then together they're a super organism, and that's just fascinating how they cooperate to get things done.
So we're talking about bees today. It is Pollinator Awareness Week, National Pollinator Awareness Week. And we've got Melanie Kirby of the Zia Queen Bee Company in the studio today. Jody Hederig is with the City of Albuquerque Open Space Division. And Kate Whalen is with the Sangre de Cristo Beekeepers. And she's joining us from Santa Fe by phone. We are going to take some of your calls today. Do you have questions about bees? What have you heard about swarms and hives? We've got experts here to answer your questions. And what are some of the concerns that you might have about bees? Are you worried about somebody keeping bees in your neighborhood? Are you worried that your kids are going to get stung or something like that? Give us a call. The number is 277-5866. That's locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 1-877-899-5866. That's 1-877-899-5866. You can also post your comments on Facebook. Search for KUNM Radio. You can visit us online at KUNM.org, or you can tweet at KUNM News, and we'll try to get your comments on the air. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Support provided by New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where increased member participation in their not-for-profit financial cooperative has increased benefits. For a financial calculator and member benefit details, go to nmefcu.org.
This week on This American Life,
I am pleased to present here on the Brooklyn Academy of Music Opera House stage.
What?
If true stories like we always do, this time turned into a musical, turned into opera. Also,
this is crazy.
We will never speak of that mouth again.
Sashir Zameda, Mike Birbiglia, Stephen Merritt, this week.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us this morning. It's Pollinator Awareness Week, and we're talking about bees. And I want to go to the panel now and ask you, you know, when you're talking with folks about bees, and Melanie, you mentioned Africanized bees, and there are a lot of I'm thinking of a movie that I saw in maybe the 80s when I was like 10, you know, those like killer pest movies. There was like the Piranha movie, and then there was the Killer Bees movie. Okay, so there's this conception that a swarm of bees, when it sees you, is going to run straight towards, it's going to fly straight towards you, and it's going to surround you, and you're going to be swollen up the size of an elephant by the time a swarm of bees is done with you. Is this kind of conception that I have, this fear that I have a little bit, is that something that you find is common? Jody, or Melanie, I'll go to Melanie first.
We've got a little one here who's buzzing around too. There's actually, you know, the human imagination leads to great and fantastic storytelling. So I think on the one hand, it's been extremely exaggerated. But on the other hand, you know, there are things to be concerned about. You know, there are various strains and races of bees. And so depending on which kinds you have really will determine their behavior and then also the level of management that they're going to need. So, you know, Hollywood has done great to really sort of maximize
freak
the
us
fear
out.
Factor. Yeah. And it's entertaining to a certain degree. But for the most part, bees are pretty, you know, they're productive. They've got something on their mind, which does not necessarily mean getting people. They're trying to actually procure their resources so that then they can feed their family and continue. So, you know, most times if you just ignore them, they'll ignore you. But if disturbed, you know, they will defend their hive, defend their nest. And in particular, Africanized honeybees are, you know, very aggressive. So there is concern for that because we do have a presence of them here in New Mexico. But I think people are learning how to manage with it.
Jody, talk to me about how you work to address the concerns that people might have about bees, or, you know, how do you dispel those kinds of fears?
Right. So I do a program for Rio Grande Community Farm. They have a farm camp, and I am invited to bring an observation hive with bees and talk to the kids about bees. And one of the things we discuss is who in the group is afraid of bees. And one of the...
Do they all raise their hands?
No.
No?
Not all of them.
Okay. I have a hyper consciousness of bees.
Well, I think it's common. I think it is common. A distinction I like to make, and Kate may have an opinion about this, but I like to distinguish aggression from defensiveness. Mm-hmm. And I think honeybees are more defensive than aggressive. Like Melanie said, Africanized is a different strain. They are aggressive, but generally the honeybees that people keep in the Albuquerque area are just defensive. So what does that mean? That means that if you go into a hive, they're going to defend their family, their hive, the colony. But if they're out foraging, they don't pay much attention to you unless you start to harass them. So leave them alone and they'll leave you alone.
Kate, did you have thoughts on this part of our conversation?
Well, yes, and I just wanted to distinguish between what we call swarming, which in beekeeping is a term in which the hive sends off the old queen with a bunch of her workers to found a new colony somewhere. That is when you often see big, you know, clouds of bees moving through, and then they'll usually land on a branch somewhere and form a big ball.
They're not looking for a human.
Right. They are so focused on what they're doing that literally you can stand in that whirling mass of bees, and they don't bump into you. They don't bump into each other even. And so that is different, you know, from a hive that's reacting because you've gotten into their nest, you know, or accidentally knocked over a beehive, something like that.
So let's take a call from Jackie in Rio Rancho, who's looking for some advice. Jackie, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Well, I just barely turned you guys on, and I heard the story about bees, and I think you've answered a lot of my questions while I was waiting, but I have this large, about 20-foot-plus cactus tree. I don't know what it is. We just moved here last week.
Welcome.
Thank you. But the trunk of it is probably a good 3 feet wide. It's large. And I'm seeing here this large opening about 8 to 10 inches tall, but there's bees in it. I'm willing to leave them alone, as you folks are suggesting, but I'm wondering, how can I tell if there's honey in there?
Jody.
Do you see where they're coming in and out of the tree?
Absolutely. It's a large, long hole, about 10 feet by 10 inches. I'm sorry, 10 inches by 2 inches.
Okay. So if you just position yourself to the side of that entrance and just watch the bees coming and going, look for bees going in with their pollen baskets filled, and you'll know they're bringing in food for brood. And therefore, they're likely bringing in honey, too. And if you can coexist with them, I would recommend you just leave them to continue to occupy that tree.
So, and that means do not try to harvest the honey yourself?
Oh, no. No,
oh, no.
You have to destroy that hive to get into it, I think.
Okay.
Maybe Kate has more experience.
Kate?
Yes, in general, bees often seek tree cavities. That's what they used to do before we could provide them with, you know, our own making beehive. So that's a very natural home for them. They probably do have honey going in there, depending on the type of bee. So sometimes we have native bees who also nest in various cavities in adobe and different places. So it's important to identify them, first of all. But the only way to get honey out of those cavities usually is to cut into either the tree or a wall, unfortunately. And then we remove the honeycomb. But I wouldn't recommend that in this case, most likely, unless you're intending to be a beekeeper and take care of them. But actually, it's a good thing if we do have these wild colonies around. That's a good sign.
Let's take another call from Clifton in Albuquerque. Good morning, Clifton. You're on the air. Maybe Clifton didn't hang on. We'll try to get Clifton back. So he had a question about transferring a wild hive, but that he found that the bees were Africanized. Meaning, and so when we talk about transferring a wild hive, Kate, what does that mean, transferring a wild hive?
Well, it could have been that he was able to find a swarm of bees, in which case that just means, say, cutting off the branch or shaking them into a hive. That could be considered transferring without knowing more details. The other thing is what I just was talking about, that occasionally they'll get up into the parapets of our roofs here, which is a little, cavity space. Possibly some people do, like if a tree falls down and has a beehive in it, then, you know, obviously you can cut into it with a chainsaw and physically remove it. So that's probably what he meant, that he was able to relocate bees from, you know, either a place where people didn't want them, or if something fell down, like a tree. Sometimes the cottonwoods will drop big limbs. So that's most likely what he was talking about. Africanized bees are present in the state, and they do swarm a lot, which means that they tend to break off from the mother hive and look for a new home. And so it's very possible that was the case.
We have Clifton back now. Let's go to Clifton in Albuquerque. Good morning, Clifton. You're on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me this time? I'm sorry about that.
We sure can. Go ahead.
So the short version is, we were living actually in the Bay Area in California years ago when we first heard about Africanized bees. and a swarm landed in our fuse box. It was the old kind of fuse box, and they were all over our fuse box, so we knew we had to move them. We were petting them for the first 3 or 4 days and decided we wanted to keep them. We read up extensively, bought a little hive, put it all together, read the instructions, put on the bee bonnet, went out, and according to our instructions, gently broke off a piece of the comb to shake it into the new hive so the queen would fall and the swarm would follow. And surprisingly, when we invaded their little space, they swarmed all over my stepfather, who didn't have his bonnet appropriately placed and ended up getting some stings. I was running around telling him I'd put him in the sprinklers, and he was chasing me to get the bonnet off. And I said, no, no, but I'll turn the sprinklers on. Pretty soon the cops showed up and said, do we have a family disturbance here? And we said, no, 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 we're just moving some bees. He rolled up his window and left. But we ended up calling a professional who came in, and turns out they were Africanized, and he removed them someplace and provided us with a very nice hive that we kept for a number of years. And it sounds like you guys, I'd love to have somebody who wanted to put a hive in my backyard. Are you connecting people with those beekeepers who are looking for gardens and the like?
So, just for those of you who are interested, and there's a couple people who've put on the website that they're also offering to host hives on their property. We've got links to several local beekeeping organizations posted online at KUNM.org. Kate in Santa Fe, is that something that you do? You help hook beekeepers up with people who are willing to host hives?
Yes, we often do. I get requests from landowners or property owners who would like to host hives. And we have a discussion group that I can post that information. The only thing that we ask is that people on site need to provide a source of water for the bees, because that's not something the beekeeper can keep running back and forth to, you know, to make sure they have water, and that's very important in our very dry climate here.
So, Melanie, I have read that the idea of beekeeping isn't just about having a hive, but it's also about making sure that you are providing all the resources for the bees to survive. So water, what else do bees need?
Well, their environment is definitely important. You know, not all plants are melliferous, meaning produce nectar and even pollens that the bees need. So, for instance, you know, if you're up in the high country in like Taos area, you know, there's a fair amount of sagebrush. That's not necessarily going to be enough diversified forage to sustain your bees. But if you can find the riparian zones or the alpine sort of environments, and literally, you know, we have 7 out of the 8 climactic zones here in New Mexico, which is phenomenal. It's very unique, but it's also, I'm really keen on trying to get more research done here so that we can actually better promote localized and acclimated stock that's produced right here. It's an issue of sustainability. And so for people who want to host hives, it's fantastic. We do need the community support, as both Jody and Kate have shared. But additionally, exactly that. It's not just, oh, here's a box, I put bees in it, and they have what they need. The beekeeper really looks to try and make sure that bees have enough forage within a 5-mile radius, but actually more so within a 2.5-mile radius, because the farther they have to fly for food, the more energy they're going to expend. And with increasing drought conditions, you know, bees are going to be hitting up swimming pools and dog bowls and wherever they can find water. So exactly as Kate mentioned, water is very critical for them. Bees in urban areas have a tendency to do quite well because people are have a lot of ornamentals and they're watering regularly and there's varied bloom throughout the seasons. Where I'm at, a little bit more rural, I don't own any property, so I actually exactly that look for people who are willing to host hives so that then we can place them there. It provides pollination services. We're able to make honey in a good year, and then also additionally be able to grow the bees and test them out here to make bees that belong here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones, and I'd like to take a call from Judy in Albuquerque. Good morning, Judy. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning.
Go ahead with your question.
My question is, am I hurting or helping? And what do you know about mason bees?
Jody, Kate?
Well, this is Kate. So We do have mason bees here in New Mexico, in almost all of the what we call the riparian areas. They're present. People rely on them. They're very efficient pollinators for orchards. So more and more I'm seeing that people are wanting to put out bees for, nests for mason bees. We also call them blue orchard bees. They need a source of mud, and so sometimes that limits the effectiveness of when people put out these nesting boxes for them. But I do have a link that we posted on the KUNM site for an organization called, the website's called Pollinator Paradise. And we do have a bee researcher who has done extensive work here in New Mexico with these blue orchard mason bees. So, and her name's Karen Strickler. So I'm not sure if the caller maybe is referring to carpenter bees, because some people confuse them with the mason bees, thinking, because the carpenter bees do a little bit of removing. They'll get into old tunnels, and they'll kind of remove wood, and you'll see some sawdust there. Some areas they call those mason bees, too.
So we're talking with Kate Whalen. She's with the Sangre de Cristo Beekeepers. Jody Hederig with the City of Albuquerque Open Space Division is here in the studio. And we've also heard from Melanie Kirby of the Zia Queen Bee Company. We're talking about bees, keeping bees, and also how to support bees in the environment. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what kinds of challenges bees face in the environment and what folks can do to mitigate the impacts that human civilization has on bee colonies. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and this is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be right back.
Spark a reaction, read, and be part of the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Library's Summer Reading Program. May 31st through July 25th, children, teens, and adults can register, read, earn rewards, and attend special events, including storytellers, magicians, musicians, art and science workshops, and more. Stop by a local library to sign up. For more information on summer reading and a full schedule of events, visit abclibrary.org or call 311. A message from the tax-exempt Friends of the Public Library.
What do you do when critters build a nest in that old truck you've been meaning to fix up one of these days, and then you discover they've chewed the seat cushions to line the nest? The wisest thing to do, Grasshopper, is to transform that damaged truck into perfectly formed radio. The method is simple and has been used by many wise ones over the years. Just call 888-KUNM-CAR and a tow truck appears and hauls it away. Remember always 888-586-6227.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and we're talking about bees today. It is Pollinator Awareness Week, National Pollinator Awareness Week, and we've posted some resources online at KUNM.org. For those of you who are interested in finding out more about building a hive or keeping bees on your property, we've also got information for folks who want to plant plants in your yards that support and feed bees and support bee colonies. Many of us have heard about the CCD, colony collapse disorder, which is something that is, kind of in the past, 10 or 15 years had an impact? Is that about the timing of colony collapse disorder? Jody, is that the time frame to think of, is that this awareness that we have of bees and the impact that bees are feeling from corporate agriculture and pesticides and things, that these colonies of bees are disappearing over the winter and not coming back? Can you talk a little bit about colony collapse disorder and what it is, and is it happening here in New Mexico?
Kate may be able to speak more directly to that. My understanding of colony collapse is when few to no adult bees are left in the hive. Sometimes you'll find the queen. I have had one hive abscond like that over the winter, and there are the reasons for that are still under debate. But they some of the reasons that are being pointed to are spread of disease and parasites and use of pesticides, especially neonicotinoids, which neonicotinoids, we often refer to them as neonics, are absorbed into the plant. They're systemic. So the pollen and the nectar have the toxin in them. So they bring that back to the hive and infect the colony.
Kate, can you explain to us what you understand about colony collapse disorder? And is that something that's happening in New Mexico?
Well, Jody explained it pretty well. The majority of cases that have, you know, that meet the criteria have been found in California and Florida predominantly because, and also other areas after the fact, but because so many bees are brought to the almond pollination in California, they're often exposed to sort of a chemical cocktail. It's not just the pesticides anymore, but also fungicides that they spray on the almonds while the bees are working them. So it seems to be a constellation of problems, including exposure to chemicals and multiple chemicals that affects their immune system and ability to forage. And then also the rising level of these chemicals within the hive itself where they're raising the young bees. This can cause problems with queen fertility and also shortened lifespan. And so often you do see these dwindling or deaths over the winter because the bees don't live as long as they need to make it through the winter, and their immune systems are not able to deal with this myriad of bacteria and virus that affect bees just like it does us. So unfortunately, it you know, this has made a lot of it made beekeeping very difficult on a commercial scale, threatening the food industry. We're not seeing huge losses of that extent here in New Mexico, thank heavens, because we don't have that huge agricultural machine that's so dependent on bringing bees in from elsewhere and huge pesticide applications. So
let me jump in and take a phone call from Diane in Santa Fe, who has a question on this topic. Go ahead, Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I know you guys are already talking about this, but I had a question regarding colony collapse disorder and the use of widespread agricultural pesticides. There have been a few really scary articles circulating lately about how colony collapse disorder is worsening and how it could have a catastrophic effect on our food supply as humans. And so I was wondering if you could just comment on that, and also if you can maybe give some of us non-beekeeping members of our society some advice as to what we can do to prevent this.
Just a note, we do have some resources posted online at KUNM.org, including a link to how to prevent bee poisoning. Kate, can you talk a little bit about strategies that folks can use and also answer the caller's question?
Sure. So on the home scale, I think I talked a little bit right before she called in, about what contributes to this. Certainly on the home scale, we do recommend that people avoid using that class of pesticides, the neonicotinoids, because right now we're really finding there is a huge body of research that is indicating that this is one of the major contributors to the phenomenon. So I would suggest staying away from that class of pesticides. I did send it's posted in several places, a list of all those pesticides that are available at, like, the big box stores and hardware stores and whatnot. So avoiding all those systemic pesticides, which they often bundle as all-in-one with fertilizer and, they're all, you know, everything all-in-one, apply it one time a year. So I think in New Mexico, we can certainly, as individual gardeners, control what we're putting into our gardens
And also, if you do have property that is in the path of being sprayed, people who often have property that is on a frontage road that the state is spraying, you can post signage to tell them, you know, that this is an organic property, organic garden, so that there's no roadside spraying on your property. So,
for those of us who have challenges with weeds, there are times where it seems like using an herbicide might be the only way to kind of keep control over what's going on in a yard. Are there ways to use herbicides and pesticides in ways that are less impactful on pollinators and bees?
Yes, you know, on every package there are instructions, and what the saying is, the label is the law. So it's important to look at the instructions that they give for application of any insecticide, pesticide, or herbicide. And certainly being mindful of applications when the bees are not actively working that area, and certainly under conditions of no wind, which is kind of hard to find of late, but we don't want that pesticide drifting, you know, by through the wind, or having a lot of it run off in an area where you're spraying a lot of it and there happens to be a lot of runoff either during a storm or from irrigation. So a lot of those practices just are kind of common sense when you think about it, but people often, I think, just think, oh, I've got this infestation of whatever aphids and I've got to do something right now. And so I would suggest just paying attention to the most of the instructions are right on the label, and sometimes they have these little fold-out booklets that come with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jody, what do you tell folks?
Well, first of all, in the spring, some of our early blooming weeds, such as rocket, it's one of our earliest bloomers, little small yellow flower. Bees forage that. So if you can allow weeds to flower before removing them, you'll be assisting the bees. Also, I believe, I didn't verify this before I came on the show, but if you call the City of Albuquerque Environmental Health Department and tell them that you're keeping bees, you can request a no-spray zone within a mile of your property.
Mm-hmm.
Planting a diverse landscape that will draw in beneficial insects and wildlife that will help to predate the insects that you don't want, you know, the classic aphids and ladybugs. Well, ladybugs will predate aphids. So the more diversity...
They'll eat them, right?
They'll eat them.
Yeah.
They'll devour them. So the more diverse landscape that you have, the more likely you'll keep down those pests.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Melanie Kirby, we've been talking about colony collapse disorder and ways that people can implement practices on their property that support bees. We've talked a little bit about the types of pesticides and herbicides that are harmful to bees. What other kinds of practices do you recommend for folks that where you're placing your hives on their property? How do you advise them about how to make their property a good place for you to put your bees?
That's a great question. For us in particular, you know, we're just a two-person op and with two small kids. And so time is of essence. We're usually juggling multiple things at once. So some of the things we look for just to kind of ease our sort of process is to have easy access, usually a fence line, some good windbreak, access to morning sun, but definitely some afternoon shade because we get, you know, pretty warm. And additionally, then bear fencing in those places where, you know, we're seeing that sort of predation, talking about predation, and it's that's increasing because of the drought conditions. And in fact, I think I shared with you just...
I mean, we think of bears,
yeah,
as you know, ripping open honeycombs and eating them, and, you know, Winnie the Pooh, right? So
Winnie is cute.
Winnie is cute.
But his cousins are not. Yeah. And, you know, predominantly people do. We have a tendency to think, oh, they love honey. Okay, well, everybody likes honey. But in general, bears will actually, they prefer the larva or the brood. And it's high protein. And especially come fall when they come really down to sort of reap the harvest of apples and orchards and everything else, they can do, you know, lots of damage, not only to the equipment, but then to the actual bees themselves. I mean, they're destroyed at that point.
So we do have some resources posted online at KUNM.org if you're interested in finding out what pesticides to avoid or what kinds of plants to plant on your property that support pollinators and bees. We're talking to Melanie Kirby of Zia Queen Bee Company, Jody Hederick of the City of Albuquerque Open Space Division, and Kate Whalen of Sangre de Cristo Beekeepers. Are you thinking about getting bees and creating an apiary? That's what it's called, an apiary. There's some cool vocabulary associated with beekeeping. Are you thinking of keeping bees in or near your home, or are you just looking to support bee colonies from afar, shall we say, with your planting or your pesticide practices? The number to call is 277-5866 or toll-free 877-899-5866. You can also post comments online at KUNM.org or post comments on Facebook. You can look for KUNM Radio. Let's go to Norman in Espanola. Good morning, Norman. You're on the air.
Good morning. I live in a farming community between Espanola and Chimaya with 4 acres, an orchard, alfalfa field, wildflowers, and about 3/10 of a mile from the Santa Cruz River. And I'm interested in making my property available to host a hive, and I'm wondering how I might go about do that to find a beekeeper who would be interested to put a hive on my property.
Kate. Norma, it sounds like La Puebla. Is that the right location?
That's exactly where it is. I live in La Puebla.
Yes. Well, I actually have land up there and some bees out there. So you can find the contact information on the KUNM site. To get a hold of me...
I'd like to just add to that. This is Melanie, talking. Yeah, and I actually live in Truchas, so I'm actually right up the road. You'd be surprised. There's actually a fair amount of beekeepers, you know, not only in the urban centers. That's actually the highest concentration, I think, of beekeepers that we have now are the urban centers. But there are a fair amount of beekeepers just around in the various valleys. And so, you know, if you talk to neighbors and if you see bees around, then you've probably got some managed hives and probably even also some feral hives. You know, what's outstanding about our riparian zones along the Rio Grande corridor is that with the cottonwoods, they really do provide some habitat. So as a beekeeper, almost we have to compete with the natural habitat to provide a comfortable abode and sense of management for them. But there are bees in the area, and exactly that. Kate's got some in the area, too. And so there's ways to connect. And I think, you know, as someone who doesn't own property but relies on what property owners are doing, excuse me, I've seen more and more the importance of even our native acequia traditions. Those waterways help to provide water for everything that's grown in these valleys and for all the wildlife that gets to be established here. And it's a very challenging environment, but it's also very nurturing in that sense.
And so when you're providing water for bees, I understand that they can drown really easily. So what do you do to make sure that the bees don't drown in the water that you set out for them, Jody?
Well, I actually have an above-ground tank that I fill with water and riparian plants, and they land on the bulrush and walk down to the water. Mostly in the afternoon, it is full of bees. But you can also put in pieces of bark that float, cork, rocks, anything that they can land on and move.
So they don't land on the water. No. They need to land on something. They need to land on like a lily pad or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In order to drink.
A cactus.
Let's take one last call this morning from Alice in Albuquerque. Good morning, Alice. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
I have a good question for you. We're talking about the benefits of bees and trying to encourage them. Well, I have a problem. Aside from killing them, what can be done about carpenter bees? I live in a log house in Edgewood, and these bees bore into the logs, and they're eating the wood that constitutes my house.
I can make one suggestion because as part of our need for biodiversity and then also just the fact that, you know, having the presence of these diverse organisms really proves that we have a healthy habitat, so it's good to see them there. But I can understand you don't want your property damaged and things like that. You know, if you see them residing in a particular spot, you can try to the best of your ability, mimic Mother Nature to provide them a similar sort of nesting area. So to a certain extent, you might be able, and this is just a suggestion, to possibly tie on another piece of wood, or even we have this wonderful wall near Penasco that's full of carpenter bees, and exactly that, the property owner said, I'm going to have to replace this. I have to reshellac it. What can I do? And we said, well, maybe we can actually put new blocks in front of it, and they'll have to drill through that, but then they'll move into that and not continue to use your home.
So kind of you're kind of saying, hey, go this way.
Yes.
Go this way into this wood that you can drill into.
Exactly.
What about, Jody, do you have recommendations for folks in that kind of a situation?
I think that's a wonderful suggestion.
That's the best one.
My immediate thought was trapping them out somehow, but I wouldn't.
Uh-huh. Or like luring them to some other home, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it has to be wood. It can't be a hive in the same way that... that the honeybees.
Yeah, it's a different sort of nest cavity. Some prefer wood, some prefer mud, actually, even too. And I would just really say, you know, whatever you're going to provide for them, make sure that it's clean, it's uncontaminated. You know, you want untreated wood, not treated wood. Mm-hmm. So.
Kate, did you have suggestions?
Well, that sounds good. You know, they have a homing instinct, and so every year they'll come back to where they, because even if you wait till the fall thinking, oh, I'm home free, they often return to the same area. And they're not actually eating the wood. They're just excavating it out so that there is room for them to raise their young.
So here's
it can be a problem.
Here's a question from a listener. Is red fungus or algae in water dangerous to bees? Melanie.
I would say, you know, it probably depends on exactly what kind. I mean, depending on the organism, certain things have allergies or aversions. Bees are extremely honed in on their environment, and they will actually be able to decipher whether something is good or bad for them, quote unquote. In fact, you know, some nectars are even toxic to bees, and sometimes, you know, it may even be toxic just to the larva, but not to the adult bees. And so it's amazing how they kind of figure that sort of thing out and balance it out. But that there's a reason to why there's so many of them, because, you know, Mother Nature can be cruel, and so can humans, unfortunately. So I would say, you know, I don't actually have the answer to that, but it's something that we can look into. But I would say, you know, a clean water source, you definitely don't want it to be overrun.
Well, so we've got a lot of resources posted online at KUNM.org, including a link to an episode of NOVA called Hive Mind. And we've posted the link to the part of the video where they talk about how bees swarm and choose a new home. And it's really interesting because you get to see folks, you know, with hens covered with bees, and yet they're totally fine. And you get to see some images of how the bees communicate with each other about where the best possible new hive location is. That and more posted online at KUNM.org. You can also send your comments and questions to continue the conversation. You can email callinshow@KUNM.org. You can also post comments on Facebook. Search for KUNM Radio. And I'd like to thank our guests this morning. Jody Hederig of the City of Albuquerque Open Space Division. There's an event going on this Sunday, Bees, Bats, and Butterflies for Pollinator Awareness Day. And we've got information about that event posted online at KUNM.org. We also heard from Melanie Kirby of the Zia Queen Bee Company and Kate Whalen of Sangre de Cristo Beekeepers. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. If you missed any of the program or you'd like to share it with friends, we'll post the audio online shortly after the show. You can download it or you can also podcast it. And thanks for joining us. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and this was the KUNM Call-In Show on 89.9 KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico. Thanks, everybody.